1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
All right, here we go. Welcome to the Eric Lang Show. We're starting. Rob, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rob Morrow, what would you say is your crowning achievement of your career?
Oh, boy, of my career. Just that I'm still sitting here, that I'm still viable. I guess there's a couple projects. I made a movie called Maze that I wrote and directed and produced, and it starred Laura Linney and myself by default. And I'm really proud of that. It's not a perfect film, but it's so much of me, and the accomplishment itself was a big juggernaut. And
for the people who haven't seen it, can you explain a little bit about how the idea came up?
Well, it's a love story about a guy with Tourette syndrome, and I had known someone, or I know someone who has Tourette syndrome, and I was just fascinated by it and how difficult it would be to exist with, something that just is socially such a, it freaks people out. I mean, when this guy would have these spasms, and he wasn't so much the cursor, that which is a small percentage of those who have it, but. So it just kind of got me thinking, and I started a process. I had some friends who were writers, and we started working on it and developed it over some time. And then Liev Schreiber was going to play it, but he couldn't, so I ended up stepping in and playing the part.
That's how you pronounce his name?
Liev.
I thought it was Liev. Did you know it was Liev?
Yeah, I thought it was Liev, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
no shit.
You keep talking Liev.
This has been my life problem here.
Some people say Liev, yeah.
So anyway, so why wouldn't you want to play it if you wrote it?
Well, it's a lot, that's a lot of hats to wear.
Right.
And since then, I've directed myself quite a bit, and I have just the right amount of schizophrenia, I think, to do it. But in a way, it worked well because I was really prepared. And a freaky thing happened about 3 months before the movie. I got offered a movie to act. To play a guy with Tourette syndrome.
What are the chances?
Yeah, it's like the only two movies ever with Tourette syndrome. So they offered me this part, and I was like, yes, because I thought at that point I didn't know I was going to play it, but I had this feeling I was going to be playing it, and I thought this will be the perfect way for me to rehearse all the business and all the gestures and spasms and stuff. And so I did that movie, and it worked out. So by the time I got to my movie, I was all ready to go. And the reason it was kind of a plus was because... In a way, since I was directing and starring and producing and had written, I could move fast because I knew exactly what I wanted.
Right. So, you were the story.
Yeah, in a way. And so I was able to accomplish a lot on a shoestring budget and time and money.
Right. So you're most well known for Northern Exposure, right?
I would guess. But I mean, if someone asked me the other day, because someone stopped me somewhere about numbers, and they were like, they said, what do you get most stopped for? And I said, it really varies.
That's a good question.
Numbers, Quiz Show. I would say the three are Numbers, Quiz Show, and Northern Exposure.
I guess what the interesting thing about probably being you, someone with such a long career of so many kind of different projects, is... You it's almost like a smorgasbord. Like all the people that in digest media have a different way of connecting to you,
I guess, yeah. And, I do a lot. I'm a musician,
Right.
I'm into sports.
So you're into golf, obviously.
I'm going to go play nine holes today.
Where are you going to play?
Start raining.
Penmore?
Brentwood Country Club.
Oh, nice.
Penmore was my country club until I made enough cash to join Brentwood, which completely changed my game because today is a perfect example. I'm going to go over there and... I will play nine holes in 1 hour and 10 minutes, 2 balls a hole, and I probably won't see anyone.
Wow. out there.
And that is one of the great luxuries, especially in a town like this,
yeah.
Where real estate is insane.
Fast golf,
where, so Penmar was my place for years, and I loved it, and I had so many great experiences there. I mean, just the characters you'd meet.
So for the podcast listeners, those of out there that don't know Penmar, can you give them a snapshot of Penmar?
Well, Penmar's is a par 3 9 hole, right at the edge of the runway at Santa Monica Airport. It's actually where Harrison Ford crashed his plane, which was a big national
news story.
Just a couple of years ago. I think it was on the sixth hole.
Are you into aviation at all?
Not so much, no.
Because I have this image. I love flying. I'm not a pilot, but but I have this image of Harrison just up there, just like not even miffed. Just bringing the plane down.
They took his license away after that, right?
Yeah. He got hurt. He got hurt pretty bad in that
Did
one.
Did he?
Yeah, he had. To, he got. To, he actually was touch and go a little bit. I mean, and he suffered
think
some
it,
serious stuff.
Do you think it affected his future roles, like in what was the?
Star Wars.
Star Wars film.
I think he had a little dip there, and people didn't know if he'd make it back into the game. But he did. He clearly has, and he's doing probably better than ever. But it was scary for sure.
So you played. So well, but first of all, let's talk about Northern Exposure. So I got to tell you, like it was mid '90s. I was 13, and I remember. It's an interesting experience for me because I remember watching the show. New Jersey.
Right.
Same. New Rochelle for you, right?
Right. Yeah.
New
well,
Row.
Actually, I was only born in New Rochelle. I was raised in White Plains in Scarsdale.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I said in an interview when I first started doing interviews that I was born in New Rochelle and they wrote born and raised and it went into the database that now until I did interviews with my mother's always like, why do you keep saying you're born and raised in New Rochelle? I said, I don't. They said,
right. They're fucking lying.
Well, they made a mistake.
I grew up on the East Coast. Sorry, let me flip this up. I grew up on the East Coast and I don't know. I would just come home after school and I would watch TV and I remember loving the show, but as a 12-year-old, not understanding it.
Yeah, it's heady. Yeah.
It's heady. I remember completely. I think there was something I loved about the set and the idea of being out in the wild. I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it was the kind of the cinematizing of television. It was the first time landscape was a key to a show on television. And the other thing about it is I think some of the ideas, while I say heady, it wasn't a cerebral show per se. It appealed to highbrows and lowbrows.
Right.
And it also tapped into something deeply in the humanity of us. It's the same thing that happened to me when I saw the movie 2001 when I was six. I didn't get it, but I got it.
Like, right.
And you got it. You got Northern Exposure. You just didn't, you weren't, you, it took a while for your brain to catch up with your soul, I guess.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it was almost like, it's Alaska, right? That's where it's themed, based.
Yeah.
I did end up going to Alaska. Have you ever been?
Yeah.
I mean, did you go for research or for fun?
Well, I went to the Iditarod. I went and trailed along the Iditarod a couple times, and then I went and did some research. I had a cool story where it was a couple years after Northern Exposure, and I was researching, I guess it was that project. I wanted to do an IMAX film about the Iditarod, and I think it ends in Nome, Alaska, which is on the west coast, is about 90 miles from Russia. And so I was like, oh, I got to go check it out again. And so I went up there and I there was no hotel or it wasn't open in Nome. It was winter and the Chamber of Commerce arranged for me to stay with this native family. They had like 20 kids and the sweetest group of people. They took me out. They had everyone from 4 years old to 90 years old ride snowmobiles in the winter. Like, that's the only way. There's no road. You can't get on the road. But these people had a site out on the Bering Sea, about 30 miles out. Like, so we'd take the husband, wife, and me, each on our own snow machine, went 30 miles across the frozen sea to their site, and we pulled up frozen king crab. And brought them home, and they steamed them up, and they put them on a table like this with newspaper and beer, and all the kids were like on the stairs watching. And as soon as I was sated, it was the best meal I've ever had, and I've had some great meals in my time, but there was something, and I've been chasing that taste for crab legs ever since, because you cannot get that. It was so sweet and so fresh, and as soon as I was done, they were like, okay, and then the kids just attacked it.
Whoa.
But the story was, when I got there, I had to get around the town, and they in the town you could drive. So they gave me a little They gave me a truck, which was exactly like the truck I drove on the show. And also,
now, do they know? They know who you are.
They know who I am. Yeah, that's why they let me stay in their house.
Right.
Dr. Fleischman.
And do they kind of look at you with a sense of comedy, or are they respect you deeply?
No,
or?
They were respectful.
Okay.
Probably comedy as well. But, but you know, I had all this stuff from what was the name of the company? These boots.
Red Wing?
I had Red Wing, and there was another company, but I had like boxes of this stuff.
Right.
Just,
yeah.
And so at the end of the show, I just took it and put it in a closet. And I had the jackets. I had a jacket that was supposedly good to 70 below. That's what Joel Fleischman wore. It was an Eddie Bauer thing. And so when I went there, I was like, well, I've got to take this stuff. So I went and I was walking through the town. No, I was driving through the town in the truck, right? Dressed like Fleischman with a video camera filming, and then I turned the camera, and at the same moment I turned the camera back to kind of get an expression on my face, I was like, I am Joel Fleischman. It was just such a trippy moment.
You're into the trippy side of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where did that, you were a troubled kid.
Oh, yeah.
I was, too. You made it through high school?
It's the
you
East did, Coast, does it,
too. It's the East Coast. It's the ice in the winter.
I made it through in that. I took a GED, which I cheated on.
How did you cheat on your GED?
I looked at the person's, I want to say that Woody Allen, into the soul of the person next to me. Yeah, and you, no, no, I looked at the whoever, some girl was sitting next to me, and I just cheated.
Did she look smart, or you just went for it?
Anyone knew more than me, so I just, I think I just rolled the dice, you know?
Were you high during your GED?
No. I wasn't
a stoner.
Did
you into drugs or no? What was it?
I wasn't a stoner.
A pyromaniac?
I like pot now, but like, no, I was just like a rebel. Like, I was just an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, I was a little bit of a, for a little while, I would like petty shoplifting kind of stupid stuff, breaking into school and, you know, just to break in, not even to do anything, you
right,
know?
Right,
it's taking uniforms from, you know, just really dumb stuff. And
you just wanted to fuck the system.
I guess. I wish I could say it was even that. I just didn't know what I wanted to do I don't have a, I'm not dyslexic or anything, but I had quasi kind of learning in the same way my daughter does. It's like it takes me a second to process different. And then in the public schools, if you get behind, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
And I got behind in like fifth grade.
Right.
And so, you know, I joke that I didn't pass a test from the seventh grade on.
Right.
But I've become an intellectual since, you know, or somewhat of an intellectual. And so I'm an advocate for, you know, following your own path, because the thing that saved me was finding something that I loved.
Which was?
Acting.
So you, and in your youth, you actually cut school to pursue acting.
Yeah. I'm in the movie Caddyshack. I cut 6 weeks, and I'm all over that movie. I mean, you look at that movie, and you see a fat little version of me. And like, there's one, you can pick me out. At one point, I'm wearing a mesh practice football jersey, purple with the number 61.
Oh, in the Caddyshack during the fight in the beginning?
I'm everywhere.
When the Skittles hit the ground?
Absolutely. I'm in that. I can't remember. I don't know if I've seen it a long time, but then I'm wearing a jean vest over the Caddyshack. I still have that stuff. But it was such a cool thing because I had caddied a little bit as a kid, and so they wanted authenticity, and I could at least look like I knew how to carry a bag and hand a club to, you know, and so they loved that I was a real kid, because most of the other, they couldn't get real kids during the day to, during the week, so a lot of them were like 22-year-olds and stuff, and they wanted kids, and so I became a bit of a mascot, you know, so all the stars would always be like, hey, Rob, you know, which made me feel so cool, and Michael O'Keefe was like, he would put me in front of the lunch line and say that I was the star of the movie.
Michael O'Keefe, who plays
Ray.
He plays
Danny
Noonan.
Yeah, and now since he's become a friend and we've worked together, and then the coolest thing was Brian Doyle Murray, who wrote the movie, one of the writers, just took a liking to me in a sweet way and said at the end of the time, he said, hey, kid, if you ever get to New York, give me a call. And he gave me this number, which went in my wallet, and it was like, you know, the golden ticket. So 2 years-ish later, I make my way to New York to start my career, and the first person I call is Brian De La Mar, and he's like, "Who?" And I'm like, you know, you remember I was the kid? Oh, yeah, yeah. Why don't you come up to the show? It was SNL, 1979. Rodney was the host, right? It was just a coincidence. So he's like, come on up, bring some pop. So I go up, and they put me in a scene where I was the a juror in a scene where Rodney's the judge. And it was the coolest thing to be at that, because there'd be like John Belushi, who wasn't even on the show, but he just would go walking by like wasted with his pants half down and his butt, and you'd be like, that was John Belushi. You know? And I was so into it. And then like 15 years later, I host the show, and I say to Lorne Michaels, I'm in the day one where they, he has a meeting with you, and you know, you talk about the week, and I say, you know, I was on the show as an extra, and he's like, what? I said, yeah. And then we worked it into a reference in the monologue or something.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What a crazy, like, you must be standing there 15 years later. What is that feeling?
That, by the way, when you asked what high, that was, now that I think about it, was one of the high moments. Standing before, as those doors are about to open and that band killing it, and then saying, ladies and gentlemen, Don Pardo, Rob Morrow.
Right.
And I come walking out to this show that now I've watched for, what, 20-ish years. It felt as close as I can imagine it'll feel like to be Mick Jagger. It just was like, it was so cool. And I guess I've had this thing a number of times now where it was confirmation that I was on the right path for me, myself. You know, it was like, oh, I cut school to be an extra. This guy gives me his thing. I show up in New York, against all odds. I enter a crazy business. I go up to Saturday Night Live. And 15 years later, they asked me to host it. Like,
you right.
know, that's like, okay, you're on. There's a certain easing of ways, you know. That,
there's a force in the universe.
Yeah, like John Travolta. I worked with him. He was the reason I became an actor. I was watching the movie Grease. I was 15. I'd never thought about it before. Something I knew I was not going to be able to make it through school. I knew I would not be able to sit at a desk. And there was something about the joy, which I've heard a lot of actors talk about in terms of John, the joy that he has in acting. And I was like, I want to do that. And then years later, I was working with him. So again, I was like, okay, this was.
So how do you, you must have spent quiet moments pondering the overlapping of kind of coincidences like that. Do you have any explanation?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at it from a quantum physics perspective and time and the non-linear aspects of time, you could posit that I was aware of things that were coming because they already happened. You know, I mean,
whoa,
yeah, you know, I mean, but
how much belief do you put into that?
I put a lot of belief into the fact that time is not linear. I put a lot of belief into signs that I've seen on my road many times. Like I'm telling you now, those signs, those were, you know, if you worked backward from that event of hosting Saturday Night Live, then you'd have to go back to the time where I was on it as an extra, then you'd have to go back to the time where I was, if you're following kind of a narrative, then you'd have to go back to where I was an extra in the movie, you know? So, I don't bank on it, but it sure, I know that the way we perceive reality is probably a fraction of what the real deal is, right?
I mean, it has to be.
You live in Laurel Canyon. You have to.
I live in a very hippied out neighborhood.
Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
I saw it a while ago before I lived there, though. So I'm relatively new. I've only lived there like a year and a half.
It captures the kind of concept of Laurel Canyon.
It sure does, yeah. I guess I need to give it another watch.
You should.
You know, you're talking about time makes me think of one of my favorite films, Donnie Darko.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that.
Is there another film that sort of represents this?
2001 is the one. And oddly enough, here you go again, because what was the boy in the 6-year-old who had no idea about these kind of concepts did know? Like, I wasn't just like, oh, spaceships. Like, I was like, oh, wow, life exists. Somehow it was touching something in me that was either eternal or aware. And that movie is the ultimate movie about timelessness.
So do you believe, like, so here you are at present moment. I'm kind of drawing a timeline here. If you're here, for you, it's over here. If you're here on the timeline where you are right now and you have all this history behind you, do you believe on some level that you were going to get here to right here to this exact table with a microphone in front of you, whether you had gone up, down, left, right?
No.
You don't believe that?
No, because you make choices and that determines, you know.
So you do believe in like a self-engineered fate?
Somewhat. You know, I think there's different paths. You know, you could look at a parallel universe and say that for every story I'm telling you, there's the equal and opposite. There's the ones that I didn't get out of school, that I got arrested, that I ended up in jail,
whoa,
that I didn't make it as an actor, you know, that I became like the biggest actor in the world. Like, every possibility. So I don't think fate is deterministic. I don't think your fate is a foregone conclusion. There's certain things you can do. If I go and kill someone, it's going to inform the rest of my life.
Right.
You could say that was the path I was on.
You could become a famous murderer.
I could become a famous murderer.
You could become, what's his name, How to Make a Murderer?
Oh,
Avery?
Steve Avery?
Steve, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So do you ascribe any of this wonderful thought to your golf game, your golf experience?
Well, it's interesting with golf, like, you know, there's something about visualizing and seeing, you know, the result before you play that can be helpful, and not just golf and everything. And I've used that.
You've actually used that for acting?
Oh yeah, for everything in life. No,
so wait, so someone calls you, say, I got an offer,
right?
Or I want you to read something,
right?
You will actually visualize yourself obtaining that.
Yeah, like if I have a meeting, it's not even so much that, but if I have a meeting, say, and it's someone intimidating, you know, some big shot that I'm going to go meet with about something, I meditate every day. So in my meditation, I will do like a visualization of seeing that going well and, you know, the connection with them and it positive, not necessarily that, you know, you got the job, but I'll foresee a positive experience. And I've proved to myself that it helped. I mean, I've had that result play out. So, and rarely do I have the opposite. I may not get the gig, but rarely do I, you know, really focus on something being positive, and it goes negative. Like, that doesn't mean I get everything I want. Far from it. But the experience is a good one as opposed to a shitty one.
I see a lot of connections between golf and meditation. And in fact, one of the projects that got me into kind of where I am now, which I could easily determine as this kind of strange occurrence, twists of events that, I mean, I shouldn't be here, right? Like, I shouldn't be into golf. But I sort of started playing golf through my brother 7 years ago, watched Caddyshack, listened to Bill Murray talk about the Dalai Lama, was totally floored because I was already open to those ideas as a LSD guy, as a pothead who had gotten sober.
Right.
And so I was open to those ideas, and then sort of come to find all these examples of how golf is a really not only meditative, but like literally, you know, Eastern kind of game. And
yeah, I love that book, Golf and the Kingdom.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Michael Murphy, the author, started Esalen.
That's right.
And that blew my fucking mind.
Right, right.
If you haven't heard of Esalen, it's like the hippiest hot spring retreat in Big Sur.
Right.
And you can barely make a reservation. It's not expensive. They're just like not picking up the phone.
I went up there and took a groovy, a golf weekend.
Shivas Irons?
Yeah.
You've done that?
Yeah. It was so cool. It was so cool because you do things like you play.
You played Pebble with the candles.
We weren't in Pebble. We were at Clint Eastwood's got a place called Tiahama or whatever.
Yeah.
Or somewhere in Tiahama, inland, I think. A little.
Yeah.
We were there. And you do things like you play around at night,
right,
which was great. And you play around with one club.
Right.
You know, but stuff that silent, I carry
you play
with
a silent
me.
Hole?
Play a silent hole.
No talking.
Yeah.
I remember that one being very strange.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
Well, because I play a lot by myself. I play a lot with friends, but I play a lot in order to keep my game at any respectable level, I squeeze in this like I'm going to do today. So I'll play by myself with earphones. So I can get pretty quiet out.
What do you listen to?
You know, whatever the music is that I'm, you know, I'm into so much music.
Yeah, everything. Country.
Yeah, I mean, I love country, but it's not my thing. You know,
rap,
rock, rap. I don't necessarily listen to rap on the golf course. I appreciate rap.
It doesn't quite fit.
But like,
I like Biggie on the golf course, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, Juicy is a good. It's just, I don't know. It's just like, you know, superstar. I don't know. You just, it's like I think like every song is like on a golf course you want it to be like a walk up song, you know what I mean?
Like, right. Oh, you mean like you're like Queen Victory, right? I don't know. I get pretty mellow stuff. I think. Yeah,
right. You're mellowing out.
Yeah.
What do you use golf for?
Well, I guess to get away, you know, and to get present. It's only, you know, it took me a long time to enjoy it. I mean, I was so miserable playing. My wife was like, why do you do this? Why?
That's common.
I know. But it's only when it's only in the last, you know, I don't know, 8-10 years, certainly since I joined a place. Although I had a horrible experience early on when I joined Brentwood.
This is how long ago?
10 years.
Okay.
I was out by myself and I was getting ready to play Pebble, you know, the AT&T or something like that. And, you know, so I was trying hard, and I got really pissed off. It was like a 3-wood off the fairway.
Hard shot.
But, so I hit the ball, and it like went like 3 feet to the right.
Right.
I was like, fuck. And then I did it again, and the same thing happened. And then again, the same thing. And I took my club as hard as I could and swung into the brace on the cart that holds the roof up on the cart.
Oh, yeah.
And it snapped like, it just snapped in half, and one piece went flying, and the other, which was now 1,000 knives, you know, it's
carbon fiber, right?
Carbon fiber, whatever it was, rips back and cuts me.
No.
Now, I didn't feel it, right? But I'm standing there, and the greens guys, you know, are all around, and this guy goes like, "Oh my god!" And he, like, blood was like pouring down my face.
Oh no!
And he's like, "You gotta come!" And they drive me up to the front, and they're all doctors there, so they come, right. And it was nothing. I had a little stitches, oddly enough, on the perfect hairline of my head, so that if you saw me that night after I got the stitches, you wouldn't even know what happened.
Right.
But it was like, I was like, it was such a wake-up call that I'm an actor, I could have hurt myself. B, that why? Why would I get that upset that I could have hurt myself severely? And ever since then, I've kind of started on this path of just playing for fun. So I rarely keep score.
Really?
You know, if I'm playing in a game where I have to, I do. But I don't keep score. I like to, you know, as I say, today I'll go out, I'll play 2 balls a hole. I don't work at it that much. I used to work at it, but I think about it here and there. I've played long enough. I've taken enough lessons that I have a basic game, and I can play to my 15 handicap. And my whole goal is to relax.
Right.
Just relax, relax, relax. And you know, but it's taken a long time. But I have a lot of fun when I go out and play, because it doesn't, you know, most of my friends that are hardcore, you know, don't understand. Like, you don't keep score. They're like, what?
Right.
You know, they don't get it. But I can play with them, and they're not miserable. So
sure. You know, I have a similar experience. I was like in Palm Springs. I had been playing not that long, and I don't even remember the shot. It was a 6-iron, and I was playing at Indian Wells.
Right, sure. I love that place.
It was a great course. I had paid a lot at the time, you know, sure. $80 for me. It was a tremendous amount of money. And for some reason, there was an inverse proportion between the amount I had paid and the amount of pleasure I got out of it.
Right.
Like, if I paid a lot, I was going to be pissed.
Right, right.
Because I wanted to play well.
Right.
And when I played well, when I knew I was going to pay a lot, I would wash the clubs, I would clean the bag.
Right.
And so I went out, and I was on the 13th hole. I had a 6-iron from the fairway, and I hit it back. I don't even remember the shot, but I remember I was so, so pissed that I took the 6-iron and chucked it as hard as I could, and it, exactly like you did, it hit the brace of the golf cart, folded in two, and I was left with a broken 6-iron.
Right.
And actually, just now you and I talk about it, I'm starting to realize, like, all golfers must go through this sort of like terrible twos.
Yeah.
Where we like learn that our temper is not is a hindrance.
Right.
And it's like, I think in a way, like it's a way as an adult to learn about, oh, I'm actually still just a child.
It's the worst. I mean, anger is the worst for everything. Nothing good comes from it.
Yeah. And it's like you need that lesson again because it's almost like watching a movie twice. Like as a kid, we learn, you know, our temper maybe does get us food or whatever. Or ideally, if your parents are smart, they don't cave to your crazy request for them to tie your shoes a ninth time or something. But I don't know. As we go into like adulthood, like what the fuck does golf teach us? You know, why you've maybe spent $1 million on golf?
That's $500,000. I could say in the 500. I would say $350 to $400. It sounds about right.
That's about
right. The membership was expensive.
The membership. So I joined Wilshire. I'm a member there. Right. My ex-wife paid for it. God bless her.
Nice.
But unfortunately, she didn't pay for it in whole. She only. So now I still got these like crazy fees every year, and I'm just like, fuck.
Right. Can I do it? Yeah.
But even still, like if you include airfare and tea times and clubs, like I probably spent $150,000.
Right.
Which I don't make a lot of money, but. Right. Why do we spend all this fucking money?
Right. Because it doesn't matter. Who cares? As long as you can spend it. I mean, it doesn't matter, the money. It's because of the journey of it, you know? The thing about golf, which never ceases to amaze me, especially, it happens more so when I play with people and I play 18, which is usually, at least, you know, I try to do that once a week, but every other week for sure. It's a journey. And you rarely know where it's going. You know, the first few holes, either you're hot or you're not, and you're like thinking this means, and then all of a sudden you're in a different head, and then you're bonding with this person and you're talking about this, and then you're together sharing the victory or the defeat here, and then you're done, and you come through this, like when you're coming up that 18th hole, it just feels like a mythological, you know, journey, you know, the hero's journey. It feels like that, and then you finish it off with a chat and a drink, and what could be bad? I mean, it's a great way to spend time.
Do you try to be really enclosed on the golf course? Like, do you ever look at your cell phone, or to you, is it just like you're isolated there? And it's
I know I'm pretty. I look at the phone, and you know, like if there's times where I say, you know, I don't want to deal with anything, and I will not look at it. But for the most part, you know, because I have a wife and daughter, I always just kind of check in and key in, and
you got to stay connected.
Yeah, and I always feel like, well, I'm so lucky to be out here, especially if it's a weekday. Like, you know, this is, you know, it's kind of my work day is playing nine holes. You know, so like I should check in and see if my agent's calling or something.
All right, everybody, time for some reads. Look, I know if you're listening to this, some things about you. I have some demographics on you. I know that you have ears. I know that you probably play golf. But beyond most of that, I know that you have skin. Okay? And just like an astronaut, if you're going to go to space, what are you going to wear? Yes, a spacesuit. So you're a golfer, or you're, let's even boil it down even more simply. You're a human living on planet Earth. I also know that you live on planet Earth. I know that. So if you live on planet Earth and you're a human, you're going to want to take care of your what? No, not what you're thinking. Although, good idea, what you want to take care of is your skin. And these two guys have found a way to do it. One of them is a golfer, so you can trust them as far as you can throw them. He's not a huge guy, so you could probably throw him. If you're big, I could say you could probably chuck him 5.5, 6 feet. Depending on the angle, you know, if you had a downwind, downhill, you can maybe get him 8 feet. But look, he's a golfer. His friend is a doctor. This is not a joke. It's not a setup for a joke. They basically were out on the golf course one day and they're like, why does all the skincare BS? Why am I spraying on this stuff that smells bad, tastes bad, burns my eyes, whatever it is? So they launched this thing called Sun Care, S-O-N-N-E, Care. And it's actually pretty cool. It comes in these two little bottles. About the size of, what is the size of this thing? It's kind of like the size of, it's not really like the size of anything. It's 1 inch wide and 3.5 inches tall. There you go. and you get two bottles. If you go online, suncare.com, sonnecare.com/Eric, and if you use the code Eric at checkout, you'll get more than half off. And I think it's like $20 for these two bottles. You put one on in the morning and one on at night. Look, I'm not saying you're stupid, but I'm definitely lazy. So having one to put on in the morning and one at night simplifies everything. And the stuff's vegan, which is great if you have vegan friends. Or if you're vegan yourself, actually, it's great. Check it out. Use the code Eric at checkout, suncare.com, sonnecare.com. Support golfers and doctors, although doctors don't need that much support. I mean, unless they're Doctors Without Borders, and I don't know if this guy has any borders, but just check it out. Moving on, Adidas. Obviously, you need to wear shoes on the golf course unless you're like me and you play barefoot. But even still, I have to wear shoes to get to the golf course. That's true, okay? And I choose to wear Adidas, obviously. I also am contractually obligated to wear Adidas at this point. But that doesn't mean that I don't love them. Go to adidas.com, click on the golf thing, get yourself some golf shoes. Obviously, there are a lot of people wearing them, including yours truly. I kind of like the Tour 360 knits. I'm not really a spike guy. I kind of like the spikeless shoes, and they've got a cool new line of Adicross things coming out that I wear, and I don't feel like a jerk wearing them out after the round, you know what I mean? And they've actually got really good stability, which is nice because I'm a kind of an unstable guy, if you didn't know already. Vice Golf, guys, Vice Golf Balls. Not only are their commercials hilarious, and the guy who's in them is so funny, it just makes me want to buy them all by itself. Anyway, check them out. Go online. You know the deal. Five dozen. It's basically they pay you $80. That's how it works. Top performing golf ball, half the price. No money goes to the middleman. You cannot get them in a pro shop. Why? Because then it would cost you more money. So they have gone out and murdered the middleman in a good way. Everyone's happy. No one likes a middleman except the middleman himself, which obviously means there's something wrong with that equation. ViceGolf.com, check it out. Some good golf balls. I play with them. I don't have to make excuses for myself. I still trounce all the four-year-olds I play with and even some 10-year-olds. You know, let's be honest. I'm starting to step up my game a little bit. My handicap's going down. I'm looking forward to the club championship. I know I mentioned it. I'm going to be gaming a vice ball, and I might even get a special edition one because you can get them personalized. Anyway, that's enough from me. Keep enjoying the interview. Thanks for listening, and I appreciate your support.
I just poured us some water, but it looks hella cloudy. Jeff, did you taste it? Did you die yet? What's in this fucking water? Oh, maybe there's a citrus in it. Oh,
yeah, I think that's a little lemon. Yeah.
Oh, it's like expensive water.
Oh.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It's either expensive or poisonous. Or in between.
It could be both, actually. Sometimes. Okay. That's really beautiful, you know, because I think, you know, it sounds like, you know, you've seen all the sides of the golf game from growing up, humble beginnings, right? Like caddying as a kid, you know, being in, I mean, having a foothold in one of the greatest pieces of golf media that's ever been created.
Right.
Right. I mean, you're kind of the, you know, it's like Where's Waldo of golf, and for my story at least, you know,
yeah.
SNL. What, I mean, you must have some like, I love the randomness of the game. I love when you show up to a place like Penmar and you have no idea who's about to join you. They might not speak English. You might already know them.
I had so many great conversations with so many odd ducks on that. Great characters, you know. Just interesting days. I played there a lot for a good long year, a good many years.
Do any stick out to you as being particularly interesting, worthwhile of a few minutes on this sort of rambling podcast? I've never asked this question. it's definitely a go. It's a Hail Mary. Rob's sort of rubbing his lips. He's not sure.
The one that's the most interesting. I actually wrote it's called the book, but it's like 30,000 words. It's available on iBooks or something. But about my experience at the AT&T. I played in that, and I wasn't really ready. I shouldn't really have played in it, but I leveraged my position into it.
Right.
And
solid.
It was wild because it was like, picture you're a mediocre 10th grade football athlete, as I was, and you wake up and you're playing in the Super Bowl. That's what it was. I mean, there was Phil Mickelson two holes ahead of me or whatever. You know, it was like thousands of people, you know, lining the box, you know, when we came up the 18th. The intimidation of it was so overwhelming.
So let me just explain. So for those of you that don't know what Rob's talking about, this is the yearly PGA Tour event, AT&T Pro-Am at Pebble Beach. It's
started
two-man
as
teams.
The Bing Crosby,
yeah,
Clam
the Clam Bake,
yeah.
Right? And it's a two-man teams. So basically, a celebrity gets paired with a pro golfer.
Yeah,
and you play together for 3 days, maybe four if you're lucky.
I was three and glad because I didn't think I could handle the stress of the fourth day. Well, but I was only off by a couple. I guess it was like three strokes to make the cut.
Who'd you play with?
A kid named Troy Merritt, his rookie year.
I've met Troy Merritt from Idaho.
Yeah,
good
great
guy.
Great guy.
Great sense of humor,
he
actually.
He was lovely, yeah. He was really lovely.
Very dry.
Yeah, yeah. And it was his first year in the PGA, and, you know, so he was a little overwhelmed too. But,
right.
But he held himself great.
And yeah, because, so I had the, I was working at the Waste Management this year.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, I was sort of just doing my job, and my client was Waste Management, so they obviously had a stick presence to throw around. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they said to me on Tuesday night, as we finished shooting, and they were like, do you want to play in the Pro-Am tomorrow? And I was like, the Pro-Am?
Yeah,
like,
oh, cool.
Like, are you kidding me? And they're like, yeah, did you bring your clubs? I'm like, no, I'm working. I didn't bring my clubs. Like, right. I don't even have golf shoes. So anyway, I had to muster that. And I'm not an actor. I've never stood in front of, you know, people
right.
like that. I've never had to deliver lines authentically in front of even just a modest crew.
Right.
Right? Like, so it was wild having
sure.
to go out in front of that many people.
How'd you do?
Well, my main goal was on 16, I just wanted to hit the green.
Right.
And I was freaking the fuck out because my swing wasn't quite sorted, you know?
Right.
And I'm like a 10 handicap. So I'm kind of the guy that I have a good looking swing. Everyone
right.
thinks I'm sandbagging.
Right.
But then they see me go OB three times and they're like, oh, okay, that's where the 10 shots
right,
comes
right.
from. So yeah, I mean, I was out there early practicing. What shot am I hitting today? And the funny thing is, to talk about the mystical side of golf, is we walked up to 16 and I forgot everything I know about golf. Because it's just so much intensity. I went skydiving recently.
Yeah.
And I think they're actually very similar.
Huh.
Hitting a shot in front of an uncomfortably large group of people, where they're all watching, or jumping out of a plane, they both were things that I was terrified of.
Yeah.
And they both worked out fine.
There you go.
I hit the green.
There you go.
And I landed on my feet.
Was that a par three?
Yeah, it's a little par three. It's like, I think it was from the amateur tees, it was playing like 142
right.
and something like that.
Nice.
I hit a 9-iron, hit the green.
Nice.
Charlie Hoffman and I were a foot away.
Right.
And I was like, all right.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, that's the great thing about the sport, is that you can hit a shot as good as one of those guys.
Right.
Not, you won't do it all the time, but you can.
You can.
Yeah.
You can hit a shot as good or better than the best player in the world.
Right.
As often as you want.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not true.
I wish as often
so
as
there's
I
sort
want.
Of like an equal quality among everybody.
Yeah.
In golf. Which is
yeah.
different from like basketball. You're never going to be like LeBron James
no
on the
way.
Court or
right.
Steph on, you know.
No, you're never going to stuff Steph Curry like
right.
a tissue.
Right. Right.
I mean, it's funny you talk about, you know, sort of waking up with your ability playing on a professional level. Like, golf does have that too, with like, you can play the same courses. You can, you know, it's strangely much more accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny that it's kind of has this elitist kind of, you know, the way it's described, you know, but it does, you know, places like Penmore and anything but elitist.
Right, right. How do you find, because I'm assuming you played golf for a long time before joining a club or even maybe even being a guest at a private club.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, I play, well, although I got to play as a caddy when I was a caddy as a kid,
right.
so we got to play, but I didn't know what I was doing at all. I started to take, on Northern Exposure, my character played, so I started taking lessons just so I could look like I knew what I was doing.
Is that the beginning of it? No, but you had an interest in golf prior.
I had an interest only in that I had caddied and played a bit as a kid because I had caddied, but it didn't...
So there was no bug?
No.
You were caddying really just to make $20.
It was the closest place that I could make a you know, some money as a 13-year-old.
Fascinating. So do you look at that as a sense of synchronicity here? You caddied, you wanted to be an actor, so you ended up in Caddyshack because of your random experience. And then now here you are, you know, member at a country club, playing golf once, twice a week.
And that end up, you know, and that Northern Exposure became the reason that I took lessons, which then got me excited about it, you know.
Does he ever play golf on the show?
Yeah. Yeah, like, but it was, you know, these kind of makeshift golf courses in the tundra, you know, where Ed would put like a flag on a mountain and I'd have to try to get it there. There's a couple episodes for sure.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Did you find, similar to the way you were sort of revisiting Alaska, driving down the street in this truck, pointing the camera on yourself, realizing that you are the actor that you had portrayed, you are the character. Right. Did you ever have that with golf where you're like, wait a minute, I read a script and now here I am. Like what's that movie with Will Ferrell? The one where he's like...
Stranger Than Fiction.
Stranger Than Fiction, yeah, where he has to write it for it to happen.
Yeah, I'm not following you. I want to. I like the idea. I just don't quite say what the question is.
I was reaching for a high shelf.
Right.
Basically, you know, do you ever now experience yourself playing golf and look back on Joel's character, the character of Joel, and say, wait, I've already done this. I
don't think so.
Okay. Well, I tried.
Do you mean like deja vu in a way? Or?
Kind of like that, but more like you got to watch the roles that you pick because you could become them is what I'm kind of getting at.
Well, that's a good thing, you know, especially, yeah, like, yeah, I love that about parts that, you know, I'm always looking for. I've developed a couple golf TV shows or music TV shows so that I can do what I love and get paid for it.
Right.
You know, we've tried so many different concepts of golf. It's true.
Why does it not work?
The main reason is in order to do it right. Like, so the obvious story for someone like me is a guy who was just made the tour and then, you know, when he was 23 and then got married and had kids and had to give it up, right? Mm. Or thought he was on the hunt to make the tour. And then, you know, 30 years later decides to try to make the seniors, you know?
Right.
But the problem is in order to do it, you got to get the PGA behind it.
Sure.
And in order to get the PGA behind it, you have to then say, oh, well, there'll be no drugs and no sex and no cursing and no, like, so you're like, fuck, well, that. What do we do, right?
Yeah.
So, and if you don't have them, how do you shoot the tournaments? Like, you
right.
can't.
So, right.
That's the tricky part.
Yeah. We had, you know, Ron Shelton, we had him Tin Cup writer-director, and, you know, it was interesting. He had all of those parties in line. I wonder, we didn't ask him about that, though. I didn't.
For a movie, you can get away with it because you're saying, you know, especially if it's a big budget and you're paying.
Right.
You know, I'm sure for Tin Cup, they paid some cash,
right.
You know, heavy cash to get wherever they needed to go. But the problem is, and, you know, for a TV show, you're saying, you know, I need to come out to 20 events or 15 events a year,
right.
You know, or 10 events even, or 8 events even, and I need to be able to infiltrate and come around with cameras and guys, you know, it's like they'll be like, we don't need you, you know.
Right, right.
So
I think one of the things that's interesting to me is like if you look at there are lots of movies about baseball. I would actually like, Jeff, can we do this at some point? Can we break down, because Jeff's his movie expert, right?
Yeah.
He knows everything about everything.
Well, there's only what, 4 golf movies I can think of on the top of my head.
There might be 6. There's like 2. There's like a couple of 7 Days in Heaven.
Golf in the Kingdom. I don't know why that wasn't made.
It got done, and it sucks.
Who made that?
Mindy.
What's
Mindy.
It called?
Her name is Mindy Afrimi, and
is it
her
called
partner.
Golf in the Kingdom?
It's called Golf in the Kingdom.
That's funny. I
and know. It's atrocious.
Is that one on your list?
No, it wasn't.
No. As of now, we've got Tin Cup, 7 Days in Utopia, or whatever. That no, you didn't. Right. That
what's
was
the one that plays every day on the Golf Channel?
Greatest Game Ever Played.
Yes.
Bagger Vance. Yeah,
right. Bagger Vance. Caddyshack. I mean, you've got under 10.
Right.
Pat and Mike.
Right.
That's like an old.
I don't know that one.
Catherine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, they play.
They shot that in Ojai, I think.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Remind me
you
about
gotta
that.
You got to check that out.
Pat and Mike.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Fuck, I don't know that one. But anyway, you've got all these other sports, right? Baseball, basketball, football. A lot of movies around those. A lot of great movies. Rudy, Bull Durham, Field of Dreams, so many amazing films. What is it? Like those sports are obviously cool. They have the masculinity.
Golf is just not, you know, it's not kind of dramatic in the Aristotelian sense. Like it's so slow and it's so repetitive and it's so hard to capture, you know.
Right.
It's hard. It's a hard sport to make. I mean, most of those movies didn't do any business. Bagger Vance was a bust.
Yeah.
The Greatest Game was a bust.
Right.
Tin Cup was because they found the human story. You know, they found a great story. I mean,
but even that, Ron said it didn't make a bunch of money.
Oh,
right?
Really?
It became a bit of a cult film.
Yeah. It was an expensive movie, I think. It was like $60 million. Kevin Costner, you know, big movie stars. So.
Right.
A lot of above the line costs there,
But even Caddyshack, I'm pretty sure, wasn't like.
So then maybe Happy Gilmore. That's probably the only one that was like a mega hit.
About that.
Yeah.
Caddyshack was a hit. I mean, certainly in over the years, it's made $1 zillion.
Ton of money. But you know, I don't know. I just look at it. I'm like, let's move it. Let's pull away all the things we know about it. And why aren't there more awesome golf movies? What the fuck is the problem?
It's hard to do. It's a really tricky thing to pull off. You know, it's really hard to make interesting. You know, in a movie, let's just say in your movie, your golf movie, it's you know, someone gets, you know, it's got to be someone kind of finding their way into the big leagues or something like that, or
right.
You know, and they get their chance and they're on, but then you have to truncate 18 holes. Can't have it be 2 hours of golf, you know. So
right.
It's like, how do you make that dramatic story? You know, how many montages of scenes of putts going in the hole? You know, like it's not cinematic ultimately.
No. Yes, I'm.
That's why I think with Happy Gilmore, they were like breaking away from a lot of the, you know, norms of golf.
Mm.
So that's why it probably worked, because
right.
It was just like away from all the preconceived ideas of how we thought of golf. Tournament was and all the mechanics of it.
Yeah, and he was having such fun at the expense of the game in a way.
Well, and it's great too, because it's got that the comedy that I miss is the absurdist comedy, you know, that exists in these 90s LA Story, all these great Steve Martin films and everything. Like, you know, I miss those days. I miss the rom-coms where, you know, it's kind of, it's not the slapstick era, but it's this comedy that we don't have anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
You think?
I don't know. I think the comedy now is much more real.
Really?
You know. Well, I guess you've got The Hangover would be a similar comp. But even The Hangover, it's like, you know, the funniest parts are like, you know, I'm not going to repeat the funniest parts, but, you know, when his friends pulls up and say, nah, I guess. Anyway.
Well, maybe you're saying it's like more like extreme moments. In a way, like,
well,
it's not
the bar,
like,
look, you do, you have a point in that you have to, that's the problem, is that in order to, you know, it's so raunchy now, it's got to be like the most base, disgusting, you know, because where else do you go? You can't repeat it. You got to keep pushing it. The bar keeps getting higher and it's hard.
Yeah. Whereas in the 90s, it was just like a little bit sillier. It was a bit more like focused on like double puns.
Right.
A little bit more cute. You know, I mean, I guess even rap music was then. Even rap was
innocent.
Like, I wish I was taller.
Right.
That was like rap music.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I just want to play basketball.
Right.
Now it's like, no, I want to murder you and your family.
Right.
And
be president.
And I'm going to rape
your
wife.
I want to murder you and your family and be president.
Yeah. And it's like, whoa. Do you ever think about, do you care about the future of golf?
You know, it's not my priority. I'm not invested in trying to keep the game, you know, but I care that it continue. You know, that, I mean, I love the sport and I love that people play it. I tried to get my daughter into it. I couldn't.
What happened? How old is she?
She's now 17. You know, there were a couple of years where I could get her out there, which is great. As long as I sat down on the range, you know, and just with a bunch of balls and just put them up and let her, she would hit them. But she had a nice little swing, but she didn't get it. She didn't take it up, which was a bummer because I would love to play. And my wife too. My wife swore, I mean, for years, we're married 20 years. So 10 years, she was like, I'm taking lessons this year. I'm taking lessons this year. I'm taking lessons this year. And then finally, like 10 years ago, I was like, you're never taking lessons. She was like, no.
What do you think happens there? Because I mean, so you're from judging from your own experience, right? You're you know about golf, you understand golf, you've met golfers, you've worked on golf courses way more than most people.
Right.
You still don't have the bug. All of a sudden, you have a work reason to go put some time, money, and interest into the game. What happens? How do you then go to Brentwood signing a fat check? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, I got lucky and made some money. But the thing that was so frustrating about playing places like Penmar was, you know, 5 hour rounds,
yeah.
You know, and waiting an hour to get on to play, yeah, a 5 hour round, you know, or I mean, I guess, you know, or whatever, it's nine holes. So it was 3 hours, but it was still 3 hours for nine holes. It was a long time.
Crazy.
And also for me, the biggest problem was also then going out to the those great courses out where, you know, that are an hour away, you know, it's an 8 hour day now. And I felt guilty about that.
Like, right.
I felt guilty about taking 8 hours. If it was the weekend, I felt guilty about taking 8 hours away from my family. If it was the week, I felt guilty about taking 8 hours away from the world. So it just became, when I saw the opportunity with some money and a course that was 4 minutes from my house, I was like, oh yeah. And it made me just love it. Also the camaraderie. I love the guys, you know, and the women, you know, at this course. Like, it, you know, they're just really cool people, and I hang with them socially, and I play with them, and I can go out there and get in a pickup game at any moment.
Right. That is a nice feeling.
It's nice. It's nice. It's a club kind of, you know, the best aspects of having a club, meaning not that I don't care about the exclusion of other people, but I love the idea that I can go to some place and be welcomed and, you know, and have comfort.
So, but can you describe, you know, the experience of getting inflicted with the golf bug, right? Like, do you remember that? Do you remember those, like, critical, fertile,
you know,
moments?
Probably the first, you know, when I hit a great shot, you know, when, right, you just hit one of those shots that's just, like, effortless and cuts through the sky, you know, it's just, it's an addictive, there's something addictive about that, the sound, the feeling, the effortlessness of it, you know, the grace of it, the physics of it. It just, it's something that we chase, you know.
Right. Yeah. Any hole-in-ones?
No.
Ooh.
You?
I had one.
You?
No.
Jeff's just, describe your golf game, Jeff. Where are you at? You've been in the range.
Well, I went to golf camp when I was 14.
Right.
And then I wanted to, like, be consistent with it, but, you know, it was tough. Like, we weren't members, my family, you know, we weren't members, yeah, at a country club, so it's, like, public courses, and then you get wrapped up in other stuff as a teenager. And then I went back to the driving range a little bit when I was in college, messed around, and then, you know, nothing for maybe about 7-8 years. And then I started working with Eric, who's involved in golf, and went to the driving range. I'm into that, but I haven't gone out to a course. So I've never played a full round. So I'm trying to
never played a full round.
Never played a full round.
Right.
We gotta, you know what we should do is we should
take him out to Wilshire.
For the listeners at home, we should do a little challenge. What's Jeff gonna shoot?
250?
No, you can't care. That's the thing.
You can't care.
You can't.
You're right.
You
can't,
even
right,
keep score, like, when,
you're,
you go,
right,
out.
I mean, at least, like, the first time around, I gotta just,
but that's,
enjoy
the fun
it
of it, because that, and that's what I've kind of found in my latest incarnation of my game is, like, I don't care about the score. I care about the fun of being out in nature and chasing that feeling, and come what may. That's what I'm there for, or the camaraderie if I'm with people, the journey of it.
Right, the journey.
Yeah.
I like that. I like the way, if you're listening, you couldn't see it, but when Rob described the way that you travel through a round, he kind of drew out a map of what occurs on each hole, and I thought that was really beautiful.
Yeah, cool.
Jeff, do you have any?
Well, I'm a big fan of Quiz Show.
Yeah.
I love Quiz Show.
Thanks. That guy just passed away.
Yeah, I read about that the other day.
Yeah. I put out on social media a little, you know, RIP thing, and I remembered a story that I put out, I wrote in the social media. It was when the movie, so Dick Goodwin, who I played in Quiz Show, Richard N. Goodwin, was the kind of key investigator into the scandal of the television quiz show scandals of the late 50s. And he went on to be a major influence and speechwriter for JFK and Bobby. And, you know, he was a real significant figure in the 60s and then continued to be. So when the movie was based, a catalyst for the movie was a chapter in a book he wrote about America. And he had a chapter on that scandal. So when I was researching to do the movie, I spent time with him and his wife, who's Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's an amazing...
wrote the Lincoln book, right?
Wrote the Lincoln Steel, book. And, Spielberg real movie? Major, and written some baseball books. I mean, she's a really amazing woman. And so I spent time with them and him, and when the movie opened, we were on a tour and we ended up in D.C., where they did a premiere for a lot of the politicos, and Dick was like, let's go around, let me take you around town. I was like, okay. And he was like, where do you want to go? I said, well, I don't know, you tell me. And he was like, let's go to the White House. So we were like, walk in the White House and meet everybody. And we ended up at Robert Kennedy's gravesite. There in this wall of granite is the Tiny Ripples of Hope speech. And he just kind of nonchalantly goes, I wrote that.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Which is cool. He was a really bright, interesting guy, and when he told me that he felt I did him justice, it was a real honor, because I was intimidated by, again, you know, you're talking, this is super intellectual. I was a high school dropout, you know, so I was able to kind of find my way into that.
The cast in that movie great was cast. Incredible. John Turturro.
Turturro, yeah. Rafe. Paul Scofield, the great British actor, all these actors, Marty Scorsese.
Had a little cameo there.
Marty's in there.
Senate hearing.
Who was nervous, you know, so it was great. So here I am, just like this, me and Marty, and they're working around lighting, and he's so nervous that he's just like, I'm like, so tell me about Taxi Driver. Oh, yeah, Bob De Niro. You know, we took it, you know, he just would go off on these stories, and I was just like, okay, just soaking it up.
I got that was such like a crazy year for movies, 94. Yeah, like at the Oscars, you know, Quiz Show, right. Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump.
Yeah,
it was like a milestone year.
It was, you're right. Yeah.
It's interesting. I wondered about that, yeah. Why did it happen?
Good time. Well, that was like 94. You know, it was a great time in American movies. It was like a second wave from the 70s. Because the independent movement was kind of at its peak, with Pulp Fiction epitomized, and the studios were still making interesting movies. You know, Quiz Show would not be made this. I mean, it would be on Netflix if you made it today.
There's not a lot making it to the theater anymore.
It's tricky. I mean, but there's such great material out there. I mean, it's a wealth. I mean, I have to literally schedule my viewing time because there's so much to watch.
Yeah, but it's funny. My viewing habits have totally shifted. Like, you know, with the technology we have now, and the cost of admission, like, I have a projector.
Right.
I remember, it's not even that I do have more money than I used to, but, you know, when you look at renting a movie on iTunes, $5, versus like getting out of the house, going to the fucking theater, where they're going to treat me like an asshole.
Right.
They're going to make, the popcorn's going to be cold.
Right.
And that's the only reason I'm going.
I mean, I find the movie theaters are pretty great now. Like,
they're really, technologically, they're good.
But also the cush factor, you know, and you can take a beer and, you know, and the you can get real food or like those. I mean, but you're paying a lot of money. I mean,
yeah.
Like iPic, you're paying
$100. It's like going to a sporting event almost.
Yeah, right.
Have you done iPic, Jeff?
Once, because I got free tickets.
Oh, so. Man. iPic is bugged
it's
out.
It's badass.
Me and my girl went to 12 Strong when we were in New York.
Right.
Went to like a midnight show.
Right.
And yeah, it was like, it was $130.
I know. It's crazy.
But the problem is, if you don't get the seats in the back, then you're like right on top of the screen.
No, you have to get the right seats.
It's only like five rows.
Yeah.
Yeah, very small.
Yeah, I dig it. But we don't go that much. I mean, you know, it's like, and then it has to be the right movie. And is this the movie I'm going to spend $130 or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, I think that's what's great is that you can watch. I don't see that as a downside. People lament it, but I don't.
Yeah.
Because there's such wealth of material.
Billions, for example. Great Billions. Show.
Yeah, it's a good show.
Yeah. Solid.
It's a season finale is this week. I love seeing Malkovich. I can't believe I didn't get to work with him. I would die to work with Malkovich. He's amazing.
He'd be a good golf character somewhere in there, a peculiar starter.
Well, they have him. I don't know. They did a pretty good job of doubling him. They started his arc as a hockey, like he's a wealthy guy who like plays in hockey leagues, you know. Mm-hmm. So Malkovich comes off the off the ice, like playing where the, you know, at the Garden or something. And it was funny to see him because he's.
Wait. Did I miss some big piece of news here?
What?
Did someone die?
No.
Okay.
Huh? No. I'm so confused. What?
Moving on.
How'd you get there?
I don't know.
Do you think John Malkovich died? Or?
No, yeah, don't say that.
Well, because you said I wish I had worked with him, and then I was like,
because, you know, I'm on Billions. I play this kind of recurring part, and John came on like the show after I finished the season.
Okay, got it.
So I didn't even see him. I met him a bunch of times.
Well, because you said that, and then you said that like they had. I thought you said they had a double or something, and I was like, holy shit.
Oh, because he was playing
hockey,
and they when they introduced his character, he comes off the ice.
And I thought it was like a Heath Ledger scenario, and he's dead, and now
he's talking about you wish he had scenes scheduled with John Malkovich.
Got it. I apologize.
He's a fascinating guy. I've spent some time with him. He's pretty dang interesting. Interesting cat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite person to play golf with?
I have so many friends that I just love to play with. I have a friend, Michael Lewis, I play a lot with. He's at Bel Air, so I'm always over there, back and forth.
Right. We spoke with him about being on the podcast, didn't we?
Different Michael Lewis.
That's the Moneyball writer?
Yeah, one's different. This is the guy that started Real D, you know, the 3D movies.
Did you write Moneyball too? Is that what?
No.
It's a lot of confusion.
Michael Lewis.
A lot of confusion happening here. Yeah. Do you have any questions for us that I can answer simply? Anything else, Jeff?
What do you have coming up soon? So are the Billions episodes?
For Billions for now. I don't know. I have no idea what's going to be next season. They do have another season. I have a movie coming out called Kill Team at some point. I did that in Spain last fall. It was interesting, based on a documentary based on a real story.
Great documentary, by the way.
Right.
So I feel like something that people should check out.
Yeah. So that's that story basically made as a feature.
What's the story?
These guys in Afghanistan in the 90s were... you know, they would go out on these missions and they were bored. They had nothing to do. So eventually they started kind of killing for sport, innocent people, just like, and then if you were in the squad, they would kind of make you become a made man, you know, so then everyone had to kill someone, and then it became, you know, how many you could kill. It was like really disgusting. And apparently not that unusual. And eventually, you know, one kid got a conscience, and they eventually all got caught and court-martialed. And that's the story of that.
So it was Spanish military?
No. We shot it in Spain just because the book.
So it was U.S. military?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a dark side.
Yeah. But what's fucked up is that it's not, from what I understand, not that unusual.
Whoa.
Which doesn't surprise me. I mean, war is like nothing we can imagine.
Yeah, it's a topic that I try not to dwell on.
Yeah.
Played golf with a lot of veterans, though, recently.
Yeah.
They're great people, man, using golf to rehabilitate.
For sure. It's a great thing.
Yeah.
So I have that. I have music. Music's my big thing. I have a single dropping June 15th called The New Face.
Can we hear a sample of it?
Sure.
Get ready. Turn your speakers up. I'm going to turn this up.
I'll pause. Take me a second.
Should I pause it while we... No, we can... You can hold the airwaves,
talking,
right, Jeff? Jeff, what's been going on with you?
Had a nice cup of coffee this morning.
Did you? Did you? Is it a vanilla frappuccino?
Yeah, vanilla, iced vanilla latte. Six pumps of vanilla, get enough sugar in there.
Jeff, if you're at home, Jeff and I had to talk business. Here we go.
Oh,
this is good music if you're on the freeway. You're going fast, you know? And so what's that called? The new new?
The new new face.
The new new face.
Which came about from an article my wife was reading about plastic surgery. And the new face was kind of the classic Joan Rivers, you know, like
right.
that kind of thing. And then, but the new face is the kind of the Angelina Jolie look.
Duck lips.
Yeah, and apple it? And puffed, you know, the Botox.
Fucking disgusting.
Yeah.
It's fucking gross.
It can be gross. So this is a song about that.
I like it, man. I like it.
Thanks.
I like music where if I hear a song and I can visualize myself driving,
right.
I like it.
You're right. That's good. It's a good thing. It's a good, you know, we take it out into the car once we do the mixes to see if it works.
Oh, do you really?
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah, got to be like pepped up, especially driving in L.A.
Yeah.
It's like,
how do you come up with the, so who's on that track? Is it all you?
No. My partner, a guy named Carlos Calvo, and I write all the music. We've written a lot of music, and we get together and we kind of talk about different ideas we're thinking about, and we start to jam, and then a melody emerges, a section or two, and then I usually kind of start singing gibberish over that, and then I take that away. And spend a couple of weeks writing lyrics, and then we get back together and kind of put it into its final shape.
That's I've heard this process before, where it's almost like you're it's not conscious necessarily.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's if you can get to that place where you're not conscious, that's the goal, you know, where, you know, because all these guys talk about Paul Simon. I saw the other night he did a show at the Bowl, I had read his book recently, and Neil Young, they all talk about it's like an antenna. And a lot of times for me, like when a song is finished, I'm like, where did that come from?
Right.
You know, I don't even remember how it came to me. And yet when it's done, it feels like it's always been there.
Mm.
You know, there's this great thing Michelangelo said about sculpting, where he would go to a quarry. You would see in this, you know, amorphous piece of stone the shape. And he would then buy it or whatever and take it to his workshop. And the process was to remove everything else until the shape emerged. But it was already there, you know, which speaks to what we were talking about earlier, you know, about, you know, time and stuff. It's like, in a way, if it was always there, then you just have to go through the process of revealing it.
Right. I like that.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is I'm a great golfer.
Yes, exactly.
I just have to chip away at all the excess.
I just need to remove all the bad parts. Thank you for your time, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this was nice. You guys were great.
It's been good. Jeff, do you have any closing remarks?
We can follow you on Twitter, Instagram.
Facebook.
I love it. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Let's play golf someday.
All right, dude.
Yeah, let's do it.